Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is our neighbor, Klaus Laris, who's, of course, a distinguished professor of history, a Christ Oak professor of history and international affairs at Carolina. But he's currently in Princeton, where he is a fellow of the Institute of Advanced Study. And whenever he talks about European, particularly recent European history, people stop talking and listen to him. And when he talks about European leaders like Germany's Angela Merkel, who is, as we're talking, is visiting Donald Trump, I want to know what Klaus Laris thinks about how European leaders, Mrs. Merkel and others, and people in Europe are adjusting to our new president, Donald Trump. And so, Klaus, explain it to us. Anything different?
Yes, hello. How are you doing? It's nice to be back on your show. Well, as you know, Angela Merkel and Donald Trump have viewed each other with suspicion ever since the election campaign. While Donald Trump made initially some very good and strong remarks about Angela Merkel, he said, for example, she was a great world leader, but then he also criticized quite strongly again her refugee policy and having led so many migrants from the Middle East, particularly from Syria and other countries, into Germany, almost a million last year. And he criticized that and said that was a very bad policy. And on Angela Merkel was very skeptical of Donald Trump's, as she saw it, lack of democratic understanding, lack of democratic values. She criticized his first immigration ban, so to speak. And she has criticized other aspects of his young administration. And the Germans are particularly worried also about trade policy, which Trump himself, but also his advisors have indicated, might be to slap a lot of additional tariffs on imports into the United States. And in particular, he has criticized countries who have a huge trade imbalance with the United States, who basically export more to the U.S. than they actually take in as imports from the U.S. And of course, leading here is China, but also the EU, and here in particular Germany, are culprits, as Trump sees it. And now, the Germans, particularly German industrialists, are quite worried that that slapping of tariffs on imports into the United States might actually happen, and they're worried about the further competitiveness of their goods.
Well, in your provocative paper that you wrote very recently about American and European relations in the context of the new president, a very provocative paragraph in the opening part of your paper when you said that the Germans particularly find it difficult not to look back to January 1933 when Hitler took power in Berlin. He charmed and bullied the electorate with outrageous nationalist and racist promises to make Germany great again and put Germany and the Germans first. So, and he also doesn't mention anything in this context about the resulting Holocaust. But do Europeans see an analogy between what's happening in the United States and what happened in Germany in 1933?
Well,
or you just throw that in there to get us to keep on reading your paper?
No. I think no one thinks that Trump is a second Hitler or that his administration is, can be compared to the Nazi regime in Germany in the 1930s and 1940s. That would be going much too far. But what they are worried is the nationalist economic trends of its administration, also the very nationalist, self-interested paroles he gives out for America, that America will only look after itself. That indicates the end of multilateralism. It indicates the end of support for European integration and support for the allies in Europe in particular. And they are, very worried about that isolationist, protectionist trend in U.S. foreign policy. And of course, any strongly nationalist remarks coming out of Washington does remind them what happened in the 1930s in Germany. But of course, it reminds them in a general way. It doesn't mean that they say Trump is Hitler. No one has gone as far as that, and no one would do so. But they're still worried worried that the trends in American foreign policy and in American domestic policy are going totally in the wrong direction, and they believe that democracy should be strengthened rather than undermined by some of the remarks and some of the action of the Donald Trump administration.
So, Klaus Lehrisch, you're sort of backing away from that provocative statement about the comparison between 1933 and Germany.
No, not really. In my third paragraph, I just checked it. In my third paragraph, I clearly say that Trump is no Hitler, and people do not assume he is.
No, I
but
say
they are
you
worried
you,
about the trends. You know, that, and
well,
they,
is the
they,
trend yeah. is the trend just a little bit of a readjustment in terms of American participation in the international order, or is there a general unease that this might be leading to something, if not Hitler, something in which the American leadership is transformed?
Yes, that is true. It's not leaning to Hitler, but the comparison is really Putin and Erdogan in Turkey. You know, countries, you know, we remember the Yeltsin era in Russia in the 1990s when there was a genuine attempt to create democracy in Russia. And that, of course, has ended up in Putin. And Putin clearly is no Democrat. He's at least an autocrat, if one doesn't have to put it even more strongly. Elections in Russia are not serious, genuine elections. They are really fake elections, which where the outcome is pretty clear. Putin will be re-elected in the next elections in Russia. And the same seems to be happening in Turkey right now, where there clearly is an autocratic tendency. And Turkey used to be a model democracy. It used to be the only Muslim democracy in the Middle East, and everyone was proud of that. There were serious talk about Turkey being admitted to the EU. And while these negotiations are still kind of dragging on, no one really believes that that is possible anymore. Autocracy, they fear, may also happen in the United States.
So the worry is
in the same way, but in a similar way.
But the worry is then not the old comparison to 1933 in Germany, but Europeans are worried that the United States may be part of this trend that you say, example, in Turkey and in Russia, where democracy seems to be fading in favor of authoritative, decisive leadership at the top, that the citizens of the United States might be drifting into doing the same thing? Or is that their worry?
Well, the worry is that at least the administration is going in that direction. It is tempting to push that direction forward. The Europeans are also realize, of course, that the democratic setup in the United States is much, much stronger than it was in the Weimar Republic 1930s and late 1920s. And is much stronger than the Russian setup was in the 1990s and the democratic setup in Turkey was. So the court system, the judicial system in the United States has most recently shown its strength and independence. And also Congress is, of course, cannot just be pushed about. There are genuine checks and balances which are deeply embedded in the Constitution. And we have seen in the last few weeks and months that they are actually working. They are controlling and checking the president and his administration. So in that way, we cannot compare it to Russia and Turkey, where these checks and balances are much weaker and have almost do not exist anymore. That is not the case in the United States. But of course, if there is an onslaught on democratic values and on democracy as we have understood it for the last 50, 60 years, then politicians abroad worry. And they, of course, maybe they're less have less confidence in the American institutions than the Americans themselves. And perhaps they worry too much, but they are worried and they view developments in the United States with great concern. And here, of course, a certain selfishness comes into it as well. What they're particularly concerned about is the neglect of the Trump administration, of its European allies, his attacks on NATO, though he has moved these attacks back, walked them back, as the saying goes. But still, he did say that NATO is obsolete. He has taken that back again, but still that remark hangs in the air and worries people. And also he is supporting Brexit, the UK's referendum, which decided that the UK should leave the EU after many decades of membership. And he has said that was a great day, it was fantastic. And Merkel and other people who deeply believe in the process of European integration, both for economic reasons, but above all for maintaining stability and peace on the European continent. They are deeply worried about Trump supporting Brexit and therefore undermining the European integration process. And these are the wrong signals to give out and the wrong direction to go, they believe. And when Merkel will talk to Donald Trump today, then I think that will be one of the issues she will raise.
We're visiting with Klaus Lauritz. We're talking about America's relationship with its European friends in the context of the era of Donald Trump. Dr. Larrison, I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Klaus Lauritz. If you joined us late, Dr. Lauritz is a distinguished professor of history at the University of North Carolina and also in international affairs and in a whole bunch of things on this campus. But he's not around. He's in Princeton right now and following up some time away from the campus. And we're trying to take advantage of what he's learned. Dr. Lauritz, you're an expert in European history and also in European current affairs. Let's put Donald Trump aside for just a moment and talk to us about the kinds of challenges that the Europeans face, whether or not Donald Trump is the president. What Europeans have got a bunch of other problems other than Donald Trump, don't they?
Absolutely. I mean, there is a right-wing populist trend to be observed on the European continent. You can say it started with Brexit. Of course, it didn't start with Brexit, but it became obvious for all to see that there was a way, a direction away from the European integration process, that people were expressing their skepticism, their criticism of Europe, and did not believe anymore that there should be a united European state, you know, on the model of the United States, a federal state. That was always, for the last 50, 60 years, really since 1957, 58, that was the idea in the European mind, that Europe should develop towards a federal United States on the model of the United States of America. And fewer people seem to believe in that ideal. While there are some countries like Germany, like the Netherlands, Belgium, Luxembourg, Italy, and many and some other states who strongly believe in that ideal, increasingly a lot of countries are skeptical about it.
What's happened? What's the reason for this? And you mentioned that there's a difference of view between sort of the central and mature European states and some of the others on the fringe. But what's causing the over here we looked at it. It looked like it was working well. It was sure working well for us because we could travel throughout Europe without pulling out a passport and changing currencies every time we crossed a border. It looked like it was really good, and that people were trading with each other. That there were very few problems related to the advantages that had been achieved.
Yeah, it is working, and Europe has drawn much closer to each other than, let's say, 50 years ago. They are more united, but of course also national differences are still there. There is probably not a European identity. There are still 27, 28 different national identities. And what has been decisive, I think, for the development of a greater European skepticism is probably the developments in the economy. The global financial and economic crisis of 2008, and in connection with that, the euro crisis has really given the European idea a deep shock. A lot of people always thought Europe is about flourishing economies, about prosperity, and democracy and stability really come second. That was at least how many people on the ground, you know, many voters have seen it in many countries, I would say, outside Germany. Particularly for the British, the economy was always there first. You know, Europe was about trading with each other, about making each other more prosperous. It was much less about a united Europe and a united identity and about peace and stability. And when the economic crisis of 2008 and the following years and the euro crisis really undermined that belief and questioned that Europe was always doing well in an economic way, a lot of people then rediscovered their skepticism about the European ideal, and that has spread. And on top of that, we have seen since the 1990s an influx of new members into the EU, particularly former communist states, the Soviet Union satellite states in Eastern Europe. And they, of course, have a long way to go, because most European nations became members of what was then called the European Economic Community, then the European Community, and then now since the Maastricht Treaty of the early 1990s, the European Union. They had a very long process of education and of getting used to the ideal of European integration. The Eastern European states, such as Poland and Hungary and the Czech Republic and other states, of course, haven't had that long to get used to and to adopt and to really take on board deeply the European idea, because they only became members in the 1990s and later. And while they do not wish to leave the European Union, the reason why is mostly economic and financial, because they get huge financial subsidies from the European Union, and for that reason they don't want to leave. But when you look at how deeply they really believe in the ideal of European integration, then one wonders what their convictions really are.
What are the possible pathways for European Union during the next 10 or 15 years, and what of those options do you think are more likely?
Yeah, there are very various options being discussed. And one very attractive option, at least to many people, is a Europe of different speeds. That, some Europeans like Germany and the Benelux countries and Italy, perhaps the original founding nations of the EEC in 1958, that they go much further, much faster forward with creating a united European state than other countries do. And to some extent, that kind of multi-speed Europe already exists. As you know, the Eurozone, the countries who have adopted the euro as their currency, does not integrate all 28, at the moment, all 28 EU members. And also the Schengen Agreement, which provides for passport-free travel within the European Union, has not been adopted by all European Union members. Therefore, that multi-speed Europe already exists, and I can well imagine that that may be the way forward. That, for example, the banking union or financial harmonization and tax harmonization, that will be adopted by a small core of European countries, while the other countries will only maybe gradually or perhaps never adopt these policies. And that may be a way forward. But one has to say the European Union is in deep crisis at the moment, both for economic reasons and for identity reasons. And the election of Donald Trump in the United States has not helped. It actually has deepened that crisis. Until now, the U.S. has always supported European integration. You can even say without a strong pushing by the United States in the mid-1950s, from the early 1950s with the Schuman Plan up to the late 1950s, the United States pushed the Europeans together. They wanted to have something like a much more integrated European continent. At the time, that was for economic reasons, to make sure that there would be a more prosperous Europe, but also, of course, in order to stand up to the Soviet Union in the early Cold War. So the United States had their own very good and, if you like, very selfish reasons for pushing the Europeans into a United States of Europe, or at least approximating that development or that status to a certain extent. And that has continued throughout the decades. from really the 1950s to the Obama administration. There have been different levels of enthusiasm during the Cold War. Enthusiasm, American enthusiasm for European integration remained high, though under the Nixon administration you already see a more lukewarm attitude developing for economic reasons. Nixon, for example, was deeply worried that the Europeans would turn into serious economic rivals and competitors to the United States. And of course, he was totally right, but that couldn't be avoided. If you help to build up a country or countries, then eventually these countries will be highly developed and they will start competing with you economically. And that occurred from the 1970s onward, and both Nixon and then also Carter and Reagan were not too pleased about that, but they never stopped supporting the European integration process in principle, despite some misgivings regarding the economy. And that also continued under Clinton, who sometimes also was skeptical, very skeptical about European competition. And it has continued through George W. Bush and Obama's administration. And Trump is the first American president who clearly has come out against European integration, who doesn't believe in multilateralism, but in bilateral deals with individual European states, rather than with the EU as a bloc. And one of the reasons is, of course, if you have to deal with a 28-member bloc, then you face a very formidable competitor and rival. If you deal with relatively small European countries individually on a bilateral basis, then, of course, you can dominate easily. The United States is a huge country. And if the United States only faces the UK or only faces Germany or Luxembourg, guess who is dominant? But if the United States has to face the Europeans as a bloc, 28 nations, then the balance is much more equal and it's more difficult to negotiate.
Now that's interesting.
So
and
that
do, you
is, of course,
do you think
the back of Trump's mind?
Do you think that's in? Do you think that he has really figured that out, or is this just a result of
He has figured it out himself, but I'm sure his advisors, you know, certainly advised him. But that is also the policy China actually pursues. China, for example, when you look at Asia, China loves to deal bilaterally with the nations of Asia, with Vietnam, with Thailand, and the Philippines, and so on. They really love to deal with them bilaterally, clearly because China is much bigger and much stronger economically than these countries taken by itself. If they have to deal with all these countries together in ASEAN or with a group of countries regarding the South China Sea problem, for example, then the balance is much more equal, and they don't like to do that. China likes bilateralism. Trump likes bilateralism. Putin likes bilateralism because it makes your own country stronger. And the Europeans have figured that out, and they are deeply disappointed that that strong supporter of European integration, that originator of European integration, the United States of America, has suddenly turned away from that multilateral effort into, you know, turned towards bilateralism. And they're deeply shocked and disappointed.
Well, we're visiting with Dr. Klaus Lauritz, talking about the relationships between the United States and Europe, the challenges that both of them face. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Professor Klaus Lauritz, a professor of history, distinguished professor of history at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, now in Princeton. And he's talking to us by telephone from Princeton in the context, really, of the concurrent sort of visit of Angela Merkel with President Trump, reminding us of the challenges that both the United States and Europe face in dealing with each other. There's another very strong component to the, I don't want to say the crisis, but to the challenges that the United States and Europe face in dealing with each other, and that comes from the East, from Russia. And Russia makes the headlines in the United States because of the controversy about the investigations as to the extent that Russia played in terms of interference, possible interference with the United States election. But the Europeans also have a challenge. Klaus, how would you describe the challenges that Europeans face in watching the emergence of a strong leader and the strong acting Russia.
Yeah, the Europeans are definitely very worried about Russia and President Putin. And President Putin's attempts to interfere into the American election campaign by hacking attempts and other means has certainly made them worried very much. They believe that Putin also is trying to use his propaganda machine to influence the elections in France and in Germany. The real decisive election is the one in France. We have just seen the election in Holland, in the Netherlands, has not really led to a very strong populist victory, while Wilders, the right-wing firebrand, has gained some seats, three seats, but he hasn't had an overwhelming victory. And the moderate conservatives under Prime Minister Rutte have actually obtained the majority of votes. So he has declined in the number of votes he could obtain compared to the last election. But that was quite a relief for most European politicians. Then in Germany, the situation is quite stable. There is a right-wing party, the Alliance for Germany, AfD, but they are actually dropping in the opinion polls. And even if they maintain their ratings, as until recently people gave them anywhere between 12 and 15% of the vote, so they would get into the national parliament, but they are very far from forming a government. And no one wants to form a coalition with them or accept them as a coalition partner. So the AfD may be an unruly factor in the new German parliament after the elections in September of this year. But they are, you know, there's no danger that they will actually have any influence in governing the country. The real decisive election is in France, and we really don't know what we can expect. Le Pen, the right-wing leader of the right-wing movement in France, has a serious chance to, in my view, even win the second round of the French elections. We don't know how things will be developing, but the fear is that Putin will do his best to support her. And she and Putin are actually close friends. Putin has given her party a loan of several million euros. They have met frequently.
Excuse me, Klaus, is that out in the open that the Russians have made a contribution to the French election?
Absolutely. Absolutely, you know, that's not disputed.
And it's not controversial.
Yes, it is controversial, but, you know, that is a loan, an open loan, and she says she will pay it back in due course. People question how she will ever be in a position to pay back. I think it was a loan of 3 million euros, but that's a different matter. No, that was a loan which everyone knows about, and also everyone knows that she is sympathetic to Putin. That is not a secret at all. And also, Le Pen was one of the first visitors to Trump Towers after his after Trump's election victory in November. We also know that Trump and Le Pen are close. How close, it's difficult to judge, and I don't know if there's a personal friendship or whether there's just some ideological sympathies. But Le Pen is a serious factor, and she is a democratic politician, you know, democratic maybe in inverted commas, but she has not been ruled not being being unconstitutional or being doing illegal things. There are doubts about her. There's a court case pending, but she has not been disqualified from running. So she is a serious politician, though, of course, very much on the right of the political spectrum in France.
Well, Klaus, like excuse me.
Let me.
This is just... Yeah. Shocking to me. When I was growing up, of course, when we watched European politics and we worried about the pro at the end USSR vote, which we measured in terms of the performance of the communist parties in the Western democracies. And we said, oh, my golly, the communist vote is up. What's going on? The Europeans aren't really loyal. There are, you know, a lot of votes for the communists. Well, is it now to the vote of the populist parties, and that's the pro-Russian vote. Communists aren't even a player anymore.
No. Putin is, of course, not a communist. The new Russia, which we see under Putin, has nothing in common with the communists, apart from ideologically nothing in common with the communists. Putin is a nationalist politician. And when we talk about, for example, Trump's sympathies for Putin or Trump's positive statements about Putin, then we speculate, or the media speculates, about all sorts of connections which we all don't know about. But I think it is a simple fact that Trump has some political sympathies for Putin, that he simply sympathizes with the way Putin runs his government, that he sympathizes with some of the ideological beliefs of Putin. And independent from any, dubious connections, which we really don't know, which we can't claim. But I think ideological sympathies between the American president and Putin and the Russian president are clearly there. And also, of course, between Le Pen and Putin.
You know, Klaus, help me with this, and you can just shoot me down if you want to about this idea. But it seemed to me that that Trump's appearance and the threat that he presents to some Europeans, probably the Dutch voters who might have otherwise been attracted towards the populist and nationalist candidates said, oh, we better not go this direction because this would not be viewed as just a nationalist. This would be viewed as a pro-Trump vote. You know, we don't want to go that far. If Barack Obama had been president, is it possible that the Dutch voters wouldn't have worried so much about that, but that this was really a Trump-influenced vote against the populist message of the Dutch politicians?
Possibly. I mean, the turnout of the Dutch elections was very high, it was over 80%. That is unusual. Usually these days in Europe, turnout is round about in the 60s. So that it were in the 80s, that shows that people were kind of have been politicized by what has happened in the recent past. So has, of course, a lot to do with Trump, but it also has a lot to do with other factors like Le Pen in France, and certainly also the Putin factor. So that increased turnout has probably led to a greater vote for the moderate conservatives than that otherwise would have been the case. Yes, people are worried about the anti-democratic directions many Western politicians seem to be taking, or when following their verbal statements, clearly. And there is also, entirely independent of Donald Trump, long before Donald Trump, there is a right-wing direction in European politics, and that has to do with financial problems and the global financial crisis, which is still lingering. The euro crisis hasn't been properly overcome. It has been stabilized. People, don't talk about it anymore right now. But there is still a lot of uncertainty around. The Italian banks, for example, are still highly over leveraged. The Greek problem has not really been resolved. Another bailout will probably be necessary whenever it will be, and it appears that people are prepared to give them the benefit of the doubt once again, but that is not, a real solution hasn't been achieved. The crisis kind of lingers on, and people realize that. In some countries, like in Germany and also in the Netherlands, the job situation is very good. The economy is booming, but not in all countries, particularly not in the southern European countries. And then, of course, there is the immigration factor. And like in the United States, a great number of people are worried about too great immigration into their country. And it is clear that here concern and skepticism about people with other religions, people from very different cultures, also people with a different skin color, have come to the surface, much more so than was the case 10 or 20 years ago. But of course, the number of migration and refugees has hugely increased. And the number of that has hugely increased because of all the turmoil in the Middle East, which we saw in particularly having come to broken out more clearly since the Iraq invasion of 2002. And then also the war in Afghanistan, the war in against Libya, the war in Syria, all that, of course, has led to a huge rise of people who want to leave the Middle East and their countries there and really go to the West. And that is disconcerting for many people in Europe, as it is disconcerting for many people in the United States. And politicians probably have not managed to calm down these fears as much as I should have done. And Merkel's policy of letting in almost a million refugees last year was a very humanitarian movement, was a very generous movement and gesture, but it probably was too generous for many people.
For many.
And these people increasingly vote in a right-wing way. They vote for the parties who seem to confirm their fears and say, now is enough, we have to stop immigration, we have to stop migration. And people, you know, these are populist statements, these are simple statements. They ignore the complexity of the situation, they ignore the reasons why refugees are actually coming, and the West is, of course, not innocent here. They simply focus on the numbers and say, these are not part of our country. We need to keep them out.
Well,
and it is always easier to follow simple statements that ignore the complexity and the causes for a certain situation than to do
otherwise.
That's
a universal political reality. And it's a good time, yeah, I guess, for us to take a quick break. I'm visiting with Professor Klaus Lares. He and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. If you did join us late, my guest is Klaus Lares. He's a professor here at the University of North Carolina, of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, but a distinguished world citizen and currently as a fellow in Princeton, from where he is talking to us. Klaus, we talked. We haven't covered the waterfront, but we've talked about a number of the challenges that the United States and Europe face just in terms of dealing with, maybe you say dealing with prior successes, some of the consequences of prior successes. But if you look out, not as your historian, but you looked out as a futurist, and you could see what might, if things work right and we're able to deal with the challenges that you've outlined for us, what might a good relationship between the United States and Europe look like in 10 or 15 years if things worked out really well?
Yeah, I think, you know, the Transatlantic Alliance is a very valuable, worthwhile alliance. And the United States government should come round to the insight that it still deserves support and assistance. While the Europeans, of course, have to also push their own values, and they have to accept a responsible burden within that Transatlantic Alliance, the United States benefits a lot, as do the Europeans. So what we really need to see is a stable, united Western bloc called the Transatlantic Alliance. And that consists of NATO, of course, but it also consists of European integration. And what is required is that the United States, I believe, strongly continue supporting the European integration process in principle. The details, of course, can be worked out. And that there are problems with NATO, that there are problems that the Europeans don't pay enough into NATO, no one doubts that, and that is a fair point to make. But that should not lead to the fact that the very principle, the very value of the alliance is being questioned. Then that will have repercussions well beyond Europe and well beyond the United States. So what we really need to see is the re-establishment of the Transatlantic Alliance as a very supportive and very trusted Western bloc. And then I think challenges such as we see with Russia and Putin, and also a newly assertive China, for example, in the South China Sea, can be dealt with much better than if every nation, every continent tries to do it by itself. We do need a united transatlantic alliance. Since really the 1940s and 1950s, that transatlantic alliance has provided stability, peace, and a lot of economic prosperity to the Western world and well beyond the Western world. And I can't see that it would make sense to give that up.
So your idea is that the best we could hope one of the good things that we can hope for, one of the best things, is for a continued united and enhanced unity in Europe, and in a transatlantic alliance that builds on the history of the post World War II alliance that we have now. That's your
Absolutely.
Dream for
As
a good world.
Absolutely, as the base of multilateralism and also a liberal economic world order. Protectionist developments, as we saw them also in the 1920s, have not led to prosperity. They have not led to stability anywhere in the world. So that is what we need, is a multilateral approach and a liberal economic approach on the basis of what we call the world order of Bretton Woods, established in 1944, and by the institutions which came afterwards, like the World Bank, the IMF, also NATO, and of course the European integration process. So far we have actually done quite well, despite all the problems which have come up.
We have to end it there, but what a great way to end it on an optimistic note, and we thank you for both the report of the challenges and also this hopeful report about the possibilities. Thanks, Klaus Larris.
No, thank you. You're most welcome.
Thanks to all of
Pleasure
you all.
To talk.
Great to talk to you and great to talk to all of the listeners. Thanks for listening. This is D.G. Martin. I'll be back right here before you know it.